We're under attack! The animal kingdom is attacking! And now we're going to sit back and have a little discussion about it. Join us at Film Swap for Animal Attacks.
Here is a motion picture film. Let's tidy up this tangle of film by putting it on a reel.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Film Swap. My name is David Seeley, and this is my esteemed co-host, the one, the only, ecstatic gaucho himself, Mr. Jonathan Pritchard Barrett. Jonathan, how are you today?
I'm very well, David. Good to see you.
It's good to see you. We've got a couple of real corkers to talk about tonight, don't we? Yes. Besieged by the animal kingdom.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about tonight. We're talking about animals running amok.
We are, yep.
Coming after, turning against man.
Howling.
Getting there, it's growling. Man gonna get his comeuppance.
Yep, exactly. Watch out, human
and
being.
We're not talking here about like sort of fake animals like King Kong or Godzilla, or sort of like, you know, maybe we'll talk about them another time.
Yes.
But this time we're talking about actual like animals who are turning against us.
Yeah.
And it's quite a, it's one of my favorite genres, actually. I love a great animal attack movie.
Right.
And it goes back a long way. We've had films about, you know, monkeys and bears and all sorts, whales, sharks. Of course, the most famous animal attack movie of all is possibly is Jaws.
I would say without a doubt.
You know, and Orca and lots. And what were those ones in the 70s? The rat one, Ben. I can't remember which one was first. There was one called Ben and there was one, I don't know, there was a couple.
Anyway.
And we've had snakes and spiders and all sorts. Birds, Bees. Of course, the birds. Alfred Hitchcock's the birds. So. Yeah.
Pretty much anything that can attack will attack.
Of course, yeah. We've had bees. There was the swarm with bees.
Yep.
Michael Caine getting attacked by bees. And, you know, we've had all sorts. But I think tonight we've picked a couple of films to talk about that are perhaps slightly more obscure than, say, an Alfred Hitchcock film or,
I would say so, yeah.
And also, one of them, in fact, is probably one of the most controversial films that we've ever covered on the show so far, I think. Aside, maybe like we did an episode talking about The Devils and Peeping Tom.
Yeah.
It was called Moral Outrage, folks. So if you want to go back and listen to that one, it's still available wherever you find our podcast.
Yeah.
But I think this film, the first film we're going to talk about tonight was quite a controversial film at its time, so much so that it actually Paramount Pictures, who was the distributor, they chose not to give it a wide release in cinemas.
Right.
And it for years kind of languished, just as a, like on cable television and home video and things like that.
Okay.
So it wasn't a widely seen film at the time because there was some concern that it would really upset people. But we're going to talk a little bit about that tonight. The film's called White Dog, and it was directed by the great Samuel Fuller, one of the great American filmmakers who specialized in making sort of low budget, exciting action films and things like that, but always with an interesting social subtext to them. And he's a really great director, a favorite of mine. I love a lot of his films. And we're going to talk about White Dog tonight is the name of the film from 1982. If you want to talk a little, just introduce the listeners to the second film tonight as well.
So my choice is a film called The Tiger, which is a Korean film released in 2015 and directed by Park Hoon-jung. I hope that's the right pronunciation. And it's basically a period action drama. And, well, I suppose the name slightly gives it away. The animal in question is a tiger.
Yes. There's no, I think both of the films, the titles are quite sort of blunt and to the point.
They're self-explanatory, aren't they? Yeah. And so, yeah, my one is, I guess, yeah, perhaps I won't tell you any more yet, but that'll be the second film we discuss.
Okay, great. So we've got a couple of good ones tonight.
Yeah.
So let's start with White Dog. I mean, yeah. I think I've introduced it a little bit, but it it came out in 1982. And directed by Samuel Fuller, and it stars Christy McNichol.
Yes.
Who maybe today, I don't know if people still remember her as much, but she was quite a popular sort of child actor in the 70s, and she was famous for being on a telly program called Family.
Okay.
She also did a lot of sort of TV movies and things like that. She was predominantly... sorry, I'm talking about her in the past tense. As far as I know, she's still alive.
She's still alive, yeah.
But I think she's retired from acting now, though, from what I understand from reading up a bit about her, kind of catching up to find out what she was up to. But I think she's sort of retired from acting now.
Right.
But she was more of a sort of a predominantly a television actor, although she did do a few films here and there, including this one. But
yeah,
I think unfortunately this film probably didn't do her career a huge load of good, because at the time it wasn't really seen very widely by a lot of people.
Yeah.
But it also stars the late great Paul Winfield, who's a really great actor.
Yeah.
Who stars as a dog trainer or an animal trainer who takes on the white dog to try and deprogram it, because the story of the film is that Christy McNichol's character, while she's driving home one night, she hits a dog in the road, and it's this beautiful all white German Shepherd, and she takes it to the vet and gets it nursed back to health, and then when no one comes to claim it, she sort of adopts it, and she has a nice loving relationship with the animal and is quite happy with it. But then it emerges through a couple of serious incidents that the dog has actually is a trained attack dog. And not only that, but it's trained very specifically to attack black people. Yeah. So this is horrifies her, obviously. And then she takes the dog. She wants to find someone who can help to stop it from behaving like this. And most people just say, well, no, you can't do anything about it. You're better off just having it put down. There's nothing you can do about it. But she finds this character, Paul Winfield, who decides he's determined to reprogram the dog or retrain it so that it doesn't have these violent tendencies anymore. And basically that's what the film is about his attempts to try and deprogram the dog. So the film is basically a very, simple, very overt film about racism and, an anti-racist film about whether or not racism is learned, and of course it is to the it is a learned thing, isn't it, really?
Yeah,
and but whether that can be cured, whether there's something you can do about that, like if people or whatever who have been brought up with certain ideas and certain sort of things that have been kind of drummed into their head, is it possible to cure that problem? And that's the big philosophical question that underpins the film. Although it's ostensibly sort of, I guess you could call it, it's kind of like a horror film, isn't it, really?
It is a horror film. It is definitely a horror film.
You know, about a crazy dog that attacks people and tears them to bits.
Yeah.
And it has that extra dimension of talking about this bigger, wider issue.
Yes, so. Exactly. I mean, apparently the studio, when it was first, because it comes from a novel, written by a French novelist, actually, Romain Gary, or Gary, something like that. And cool. Sorry, that's my dog coughing.
Yes, of course. We have an extra guest tonight, of course. Jonathan's dog's with us, and he might comment on the action here and there. Happily for us, he's much more docile than the dog in this film is.
So I think they originally wanted, apparently Paramount executives, they wanted a Jaws with paws. So I guess in the 70s, after the massive success of Jaws, they were on the lookout for sort of animal attack movies. The sort of whole genre had completely taken over. And they thought, oh, we've got a similar sort of Jaws type, except a dog. But they got this sort of slightly more political story. I guess it's a bit more, I mean, you know, it's not like there's no sort of politics in Jaws either. There's a certain amount of, you know, they want to close the beach and they're not allowed to close it and all that sort of stuff.
That's right. That's right. The economics over sort of public safety. There's a bit of a message in there, I suppose.
I think there is. They didn't get what they wanted with this, and
And there was a bit of controversy, because I think it was something that's worth mentioning is that the film, the book that it was based on, Fuller decided to make some quite fundamental changes to the story, because apparently the book was about a dog that had been trained by a black man to attack white people.
Oh, was it?
Oh, yes. Apparently Fuller decided to make those changes so that the film would have a more resonance as a parable for racism and the issues around racism. Yeah. And but the NAACP wanted to, they were concerned that the film was going to be very provocative and inflammatory, so they were pressuring Paramount not to release the film or not even to make the film in the first place. And there was a lot of sort of kickback from the executives at Paramount who didn't want a film that was going to be too controversial. They just wanted a piece of, you know, light entertainment.
Right.
So there was a lot of pressure on the film. And that's why eventually when it was completed, they only apparently released it in one cinema in one city. Sorry, without having to search around, I wouldn't be able to confirm which one that was. But then they just basically pulled it, and it didn't really get a wide distribution.
Right.
And then it did just end up, and that's where I saw it. I remember seeing it. I would have been, you know, sort of maybe 13, 14 years old, and I saw it on pay television. That was the first time I saw it. And I, as far as I know, it didn't play in cinemas in Canada either.
Right.
And I don't know how accurate that statement is.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, so it, and it is a film that after that, like, it kind of made an impression on me at the time.
Yeah.
I remembered it, but it was one of those films that did just seem to kind of disappear over the ensuing years and just was sort of forgotten about. And it wasn't, I guess, until about 2008, if I'm not mistaken, that the film had a re-release by Criterion. They put it out on DVD, and that was the first time that the film had a wider release, and people got a chance to see it. And there was a cinema run as well. It got booked into a cinema in New York for a week. So on that basis, then the film was rediscovered and reappraised, and now I think it's held in much wider regard as a, because it is a very entertaining film on a certain level as a sort of a suspense film. But it also has that deeper sort of meaning in it. And it talks about these sort of philosophical questions about nature and nurture and about whether you can in a sense, cure the problem of sort of racism.
Yeah. So one of the really enjoyable sort of parts of the film is this is one of the stars, Paul Winfield. Can you tell me a little bit more about him? Because it's the first I've ever sort of encountered him before. But I thought, oh, wow, he's got real presence, great actor.
And, he does indeed, and he's really good. I think he's one of the key things that makes this film work.
Yeah.
His performance, he has such a sort of humanity about him and his determination to try and cure this problem or solve this problem and stuff. Yep. He really, I think, carries the film to a large extent.
Yeah.
He's someone who's, he had a very, very wide career. He did loads of film and television. His first sort of major role was a film in the early 70s called Sounder, which I actually, if you remember our guest, David Blakesley, from a few months back, who did our gangster episode, Gangster Greats.
Yeah.
And I went on his podcast to talk about Sounder sort of last year or the year before. And that's a really great film about sort of, sharecroppers in the States and about a boy trying to get an education and things. And it's a really wonderful film that I enjoyed immensely. Right. And but he's also quite well known for playing Martin Luther King in a television sort of miniseries.
Okay.
I believe he was in one of the Roots miniseries, and he's done loads of television and films over the years.
Okay.
And he's also would be quite recognizable to Star Trek fans because he plays a quite pivotal role in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. He's right. One of the guys who gets the little wiggy things in his ears and gets taken over by Khan, kind of mind controlled by Khan, and he's the baddie in the film. And but he's just a really great actor. He's one of those. He's a very familiar face in films and TV in the 70s and sort of 80s.
Right.
Unfortunately, he passed away. I think in 2004 he passed away.
Yeah.
But he's a really it was a really great actor. Just one of those regular jobbing character actors who was in loads and loads of stuff. Mm. And I think, as I said, I think he's a key thing to what makes this film work, because I think he brings that certain level to it that otherwise maybe the film, because it's a lower budget film.
Yeah.
Predominantly, a lot of the actors in it were television actors, except for Earl.
Earl Ives.
Maybe one or two others who have little sort of small roles in it.
Yeah.
So I think he carries the film, Paul Winfield.
Right. So I thought Earl Ives was a singer, but. I don't know much about him, but I just heard the name. I always thought he was a singer.
Yeah, no, he did loads of acting, but he was a singer as well.
Right.
Yeah. He's most well known probably for recording Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
That's why I've heard
the man who sung on the record and did the one of the voices in the very famous TV. Special Christmas TV special Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the Rankin Bass film.
Okay.
Which was a staple on television when I was growing up. It was on every year.
Okay.
It was sort of something that, for people of my generation, it was sort of like a standard part of your childhood, I think.
Over
Christmas time every year.
Yeah, well, one of the other things that I thought was really terrific is the music, the score, written by Ennio Morricone, a name that probably everybody's heard of. Interestingly, right at the beginning, as the credits are going up, they've got this sort of string sound that sounds very Jaws-like. It's a sort of echoing Jaws, which I thought was quite clever. I'm pretty sure in The Tiger there's a little bit of Jaws sort of sound in that soundtrack as well. You can sort of, I guess Jaws, I mean, you know, it basically sort of wrote the book on animal attack movies, didn't it?
And I think so, yeah. It's the gold standard, yes.
but the moody music, and I suppose Ennio Morricone is, I guess, his best known, as far as I was concerned, for his Western sort of soundtracks. But he did, you know, we did Suspiria, and he wrote the soundtrack for that as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
That's Italian giallo horror. So, you know, he knew how to write for, or he did write for horror films as well.
He was a very prolific man. He did a lot of scores for a lot of films.
Yeah.
You know, including a lot of sort of Italian films that might not be as familiar to sort of, you know, American and British audiences, but
right, yeah,
but he was very prolific, and
yeah,
and you're right, I think both of the films we're talking about tonight have actually quite very good film, very good scores, very effective,
definitely. And his one really moody, and sort of slightly, I guess, as you know, because it's sort of, I guess, Ennio Morricone, it's very distinctive, isn't it? You can hear that. Yes, this is definitely you've got that sort of Morricone feel. And the film is sort of set in LA, and that's a sort of slightly strange sort of feeling as well, because you're watching this very LA film, but with this sort of Italian overlay, as it were, which is an interesting sort of choice, artistic choice, I guess. But I guess old Sam Fuller, he spent quite a lot of time in France, didn't he?
He did, yeah. I think he became a bit frustrated working in American films for a while, and he went abroad.
Yeah,
but he did end up coming back, and I mean, he's made so many wonderful films, and the thing is too that I think he was quite preoccupied in a lot of his films with these issues around sort of race relations and things like that,
okay.
and about the bigotry and things that run through society.
Yeah.
So I think this is the kind of film, I think that's what attracted him to doing this, because I think this project floated around apparently for quite a few years. It was one of those films that kind of got, what do they call it, development hell, when they're kind of, you know, they kind of pass from one, you know, around various sort of people over several years trying to kind of get it made, and it eventually ended up on Sam Fuller's plate there, and he was someone who had a reputation for being able to make films cheaply, quickly, but still very good quality and very very entertaining, and I think that's one thing that's quite appealing about this film, is because it deals with a subject matter, but it's not in a heavy-handed, sort of overbearing or preachy kind of way.
No.
It sort of uses this very simple premise and simple sort of metaphor, and then uses it very, uses it to explore these issues.
Yes, that is true. I have to say, I did enjoy the film, but I did find the sort of idea his character Keys, because basically Christy McNichol, who's the woman who's attacked, and the dog sort of saves her life, she takes him to I think they run a like animal training sort of
for camp. Films.
Yeah, for films. Yeah. They have all these animals which they use in films. Keys and Carruthers, or Carruthers and Keys. And that was one of the things I quite enjoyed, because it reminded me a little bit of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the what's his name film, Quentin Tarantino film, where they go to visit the Manson family, and they're sort of on the outskirts of LA, like this sort of dusty bit on the sort of the edges of the sort of the movie industry, and where these people are doing sort of rather dodgy things, sort of slightly involved with the music movie industry, but not exactly. One of the things about Carruthers and Keyes' sort of animal ranch is that they have this amazing sort of metal dome where they do all their training in, which reminded me of Welcome to the Thunderdome, you know, the Mad
Max. Yes, that's what I was thinking of as well, yes. It's like a gladiator, sort of like this gladiator ring.
Yeah, exactly. And I wonder, did they build that, or is that somewhere they found in LA where they, you know, it was actually used for that purpose? Or
I wouldn't have thought they built and did any purpose building of anything, because this film was made fairly modest. It was a very modest production.
Yeah, which is an extraordinary thing to have to be driving. I guess they had somebody scouting for location. So that weird dome is perfect for our movie. I slightly found like the idea of the people being just very like animals, I just didn't quite wash with me. I just thought, you know, we're just a bit much more complex than animals, basically. And then the other thing is that when old Keyes, Paul Winfield, takes this one himself to sort of retrain the dog, so it's sort of, well, not attacking people, not attacking black people especially. And although it does attack at the beginning, it starts off, it saves the life of the heroine, because she's being attacked by a white man. So it sort of it does attack white people as well. Anyway, so he tries to train it, and I sort of slightly thought, but why? I mean, it's just, this is like now you read it, because it's quite topical in a way at the moment. There's all these dog attacks in the news in the UK. Mm-hmm. This dog, the XL bully, and they're inevitably sort of put down, and they're just sort of bad dogs, basically. And I
think that I see what you're trying to say, because the idea, because it is a bit ludicrous that they would bother, like, that's, you know, okay, if you, and obviously that is kind of what the point of the film is, because this here is two sides of looking at the issue, because most people, like the Burl Ives character, just kind of says, oh, look, just put the thing down. You can't do anything about it. These dogs are crazy. You just got to get rid of it.
Yeah.
But it's the Keyes character who kind of says, no, I want to do something about this. That just killing it isn't the answer. We have to, for him, it's kind of it's more of the principle of it, that can I want to be able to try and cure this. And there's even a point near the end of the film when he says, because, you know, again, we're avoiding spoilers, but some things happen towards the end of the film that very much make him question whether this project, whether he should see it through. But then he makes kind of the big speech moment where he kind of says, if I can't do it with this dog, I'm going to do it with another. I'm going to keep trying. And it's almost that plea. I think that's kind of where the film is. The heart of it is, it's kind of saying, you know, we've got to keep trying to find ways to try and, I use the word cure, but obviously that's a bit of a simplistic way of looking at it, but we've got to try and find ways of trying to find an answer to this problem about this tribalism and these kind of attitudes that people have.
Yeah,
I mean, you can see even now today in current affairs in the news, you can see when you have, you know, people who've been brought up with certain ideas being drummed into their head from youth, and how that can spill over into this just appalling violence and hatred and all these horrible things that happen.
Yeah.
So the idea of Keyes like saying, no, I'm going to find a way to do something about this. And, you know, maybe, depending on your point of view, you could say, this is a pointless exercise.
Yeah.
But I think that's where his humanity comes in, is that he's saying, you know, violence isn't the answer. We got to find a way to cure this problem or do something about it.
Yes. I guess that's where the issue, it as a metaphor or a parable, whereas it as a sort of an actual sort of,
yeah.
You know,
I mean, it's just like the film, I don't think is meant to be particularly realistic necessarily. Yeah. I think at the central heart of it is just that question about, are these things ingrained in us naturally, or do we just, do we learn them? And if we do learn them, can we unlearn them?
Yeah.
And I think it's Sandra, Paul Winfield's character, Keyes, represents that, the more hopeful,
yes,
the more human outlook on that, to the more compassionate,
yeah, and that's
view of it.
And that's what makes him really the heart of the story, because, you know, he has this sort of moral vision, whereas the dog's sort of owner, new owner, Christy McNichol's character, Julie Sawyer, she's just a sort of, you know, she just thinks more in lines of, this is my doggy, and I don't want it put down. Which is,
well, her character is quite interesting in that she's sort of like, you know, if you look at her more as like a sort of a privileged, more sheltered sort of, you know, middle class white person, and then suddenly being confronted by this thing that maybe for her, you know, she doesn't really take much notice of these kind of issues and things.
Yeah.
And then suddenly she's confronted quite suddenly and quite horribly with the issues of racism and violence and things that maybe in her world aren't necessarily things that she has to deal with
personally
every day. And then suddenly she's confronted with it. And she also has that reaction of like, well, can't we do something about this? What can we do? And perhaps that's maybe a naive reaction, maybe not. It's maybe more of just a human one to say, well, this isn't right. What can we do about this? And then she finds somebody who takes that same attitude and says, we can do something about this, and I'm going to try and do something about this.
Yeah.
So, whereas the Burl Ives character just says, man, just kill the thing, just get rid of it. This is bad news, just get rid of it.
Yeah.
You know, just brush it away, brush it aside, and forget about it.
Yeah. Is another thing that the Burl Ives and they gain, one of the neighbors of Ives and Key Carruthers and Keys, who they go and see, is this sort of woman who lives in the sort of house next door. And the whole sort of setup there reminded me a bit of Tiger Joe. Is Tiger Joe? Did you see that documentary series on Netflix a couple of years ago?
Well, about the guy with the
tigers.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah,
him. And so he was sort of slightly eccentric character who lived. I mean, it's quite similar, you know, on the outs, on sort of
the Tiger King. That's what it was called.
Tiger King. Yeah. Exactly, the Tiger King. And that brought to mind this sort of eccentrics living at the sort of slightly at the edge of society, these people.
Who have these kind of like less than ordinary jobs, like, you know, people who've set up shop in a sort of a business or in an area that's kind of a little bit more offbeat. You know, like sort of training animals to appear in films is a fairly unique trade that not a lot of people necessarily do.
No, definitely. Yeah, that's something that sort of came to mind with me. But I enjoyed it, but I did find that the metaphor wasn't entirely persuasive for me, but anyway, that doesn't matter. the bit at the end. What can we talk about the ending? Do you think?
It depends what you mean. Are you talking about when the original owner shows up?
Well, that's interesting. I wasn't thinking
about that. Kind of an interesting moment and a key moment in the film as well.
That is very key. Yeah. Basically, him turning up is sort of one thing, but what makes his appearance is basically the fact that he has his two little granddaughters with him.
Yeah.
And it's like that gives it a real emotional weight, that sort of scene.
Yeah. Because you kind of expect him, and when you meet the guy who owns this animal, you kind of expect him to be the stereotype of the skinhead with a swastika tattoo on his neck or something, being just this, you know, big thug of a person, nasty piece of work, you know what I mean? And, and instead, you get this kind of kindly old grandfather with his two little grandkids.
Yeah.
You know, kind of going, can I have my dog back? So nice of you to take care of him for me.
Yes. I think he's almost hoping that she hasn't realized what's happened, she's trained. I mean, to me, his character was plausibly, you know, he could have been sort of, I wasn't expecting, but it was just the fact that he had his grandchildren with him. That was the thing that was powerful, more powerful than him not having a tattoo or anything, because you could see this is like part of a sort of a broader pattern, sort of like, you know, what were they learning?
Yeah, generational. And
the sense,
and also, too, is that, you know, even people who hold these kind of ideas in their head.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily what you expect, and they also might not, because people are, like you say, they're complex, and they have different sides to them.
Yeah.
And they may be a perfectly good family person and you know, kind in some ways and all that stuff, but also hold certain opinions and values and things that are more problematic and unhealthy.
Yeah.
So I think that scene is quite powerful, like you say, because it drives home very simply and effectively that idea of making that point about these things.
You know? Well, especially because they keep on talking about how did this dog become like this? And they say, well, because it was trained, basically, from being a puppy.
Yeah.
Trained like this. And in a sense, the grandchildren are like the puppies of the, of the granddad, of the owner. You know, who knows what they're being trained for. But, no, I was thinking really more than that. I was thinking about the ending, sort of where I'm going to... Well, basically, they're back in the Thunderdome, animal training dome. If you're going to watch it, don't pause now and come back. Basically, the dog doesn't attack Keys, the black man, and goes for Carruthers, his business partner, the white guy. So what are we to make of this? So is a sort of pessimistic ending, but have they cured the dog to an extent or not? Or is it like, at least it's just a violent dog now.
yeah, exactly.
Rather
than, well, that's all right then, you know, but it is, it's like, it's kind of the ending. Does, you know, it is a pessimistic ending, which, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking, because in a sense, Paul Winfield's character has sort of made friends with the dog, and the dog doesn't attack him because he sees him as a sort of his master, I guess. But
he's succeeded on a certain level, but the problem, I guess, is still there. And I guess, and maybe it's just shifted, or
And maybe that's the thing about that's where it becomes a bit more realistic rather than metaphorical, that some dogs, like these XL bullies, they've been bred to be attack dogs, and well, unfortunately, they just attack people basically. And there's not much you can do about that. In his case, wouldn't attack him now, because he's taught it to think it's to realize it's his in charge. But yeah, it's still basically not a spaniel, let's put it like that.
I think in the interest of time, we might have to think about moving on. But I guess, was there any last things that you wanted to say, or just like just summarize what you would say to someone if you were going to say?
One of the things I was going to say is that dogs live in a very black and white world, maybe.
Okay.
It's either fear, hate, or love, or whatever it is. Not hate. I don't think they have hate, but they're quite sort of one-dimensional creatures. That's what makes them. That's why we love them, or those of us that do, at least. But it's a really interesting film. I have actually seen one of his other movies, Shock Corridor.
Yes, that's one of his most famous.
I think I saw that on the telly back in the 90s on sort of late night radio, BBC Two or something like that, when they used to show lots of good movies on, or Channel 4. I would definitely recommend this film. Tell us what you think, basically.
Well, I mean, I like I said, I remembered this film from years ago, seeing it as a teenager, and it made an impression on me. Because I think the thing about it is, it's a nice, simple, engaging, entertaining film. But it manages to ask some quite profound questions and make some quite interesting observations. And makes you think about these things, despite its simple premise and its sort of, it's an entertaining package, but it's got some depth and some interesting questions within it.
It's not just Jaws with paws.
It's not just Jaws with paws. It's come on, and if you think about a film like a Cujo, where it is literally just like a dog turned into a monster. This film, it has, I think, a lot more depth and interesting subtext to it, which makes it worth watching. So that's what I would say to people. I would say, if you're looking for a cool dog attack film, this is a really good choice, because it's got a lot more going for it as an interesting film.
Yes.
I think what we might do, Jonathan, is take a few seconds break compose ourselves before we, and maybe get some warm clothes on before we go into the mountains of Korea to talk about our next film. So listeners, we're just going to take a very short break. Just listen very closely for the following message. Yes, lean in, listen very intently, because we're going to tell you a little bit about our social media stuff. We'll be back in just about 10, 15 seconds. So stay right where you are.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to the Film Swap podcast. If you like this podcast, please consider giving the show a rating or leaving a review. This helps other listeners find the show. You can follow the Film Swap on social media. We're on Twitter and TikTok at FilmSwap UK, on Instagram at FilmSwap Media, and on YouTube at FilmSwap @FilmSwap_podcast and at Facebook @FilmSwapThePodcast.
And we're back. Jono, welcome back. Listeners, welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that little break as much as I did. And folks, aside from our social media channels, I just want to draw some attention to our website, filmswap.uk. And if you go there, you will see lots of information and stuff about Film Swap. And as the time goes on, you're going to see more and more stuff added on to the website. We've got some big plans for it to add lots of things in there. So by all means, bookmark it, visit it often, refresh the page every day, every 5 minutes, and make sure that you don't miss out on anything. And I also just wanted to point out to keep your eyes peeled for our factoids, Film Swap factoids, because they're back. We had a few months off from the factoids for various reasons. We took a little hiatus, but we're back in full swing with them now. So you can find them on our YouTube channel, and we also push them out on our other social media accounts as well. So wherever you find us, look out for the factoids. They're nice little quick 1 minute nuggets of film history, usually related to the films that we're talking about on the show, but not necessarily. Who knows? Who knows what we'll talk about? So keep an eye out for those. Jonathan, tell the listeners about The Tiger.
Well, The Tiger is a film that came out in 2015, directed by Park Hoon-jung. And it's basically set in 1925. Actually, I think there's a little sort of prelude, which is in 1915. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that this was during the period of Japanese rule in Korea. So I knew that the Japanese had invaded Korea during the Second World War, but it turned out, I learned as part of my research for this, is that they'd originally taken over Korea in 1910. Mm. Anyway, so basically the Japanese were ruling Korea. And so this is set in the sort of mountains of Korea. In fact, a particular mountain called Mount Jirisan, which I think is the tallest peak in Korea. It's actually in the south, really near the very bottom of the peninsula. And it's a sort of very mountainous area. And that's one of the things about the film, is that it's set in this really spectacular landscapes. Mm-hmm. And so the basic sort of story is that there's a tiger, and it's a man eater, and he's a big one,
isn't he?
He is massive, absolutely massive. And the reason is because, I mean, I don't know if you ever been to a zoo to see a tiger?
I've seen tigers.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I went a few years ago to a zoo where they had a tiger. I was thinking, wait a second, this tiger is seriously massive compared to the tiger I saw in the zoo. And it turns out that's because most tigers in zoos are, I guess, Bengal tigers, which is the more common type of tiger. This is a Siberian tiger, which is a different beast altogether. It's much, much bigger. Actually, it's sometimes called an Amur tiger. And they're the biggest of all the, I think there's three or four breeds of tigers, and they're the biggest of the lot. And so that explains why this tiger is so gigantic. And basically the local sort of governor, I guess he is, or sort of general, Japanese general who's ruling the area, he loves hunting. Well, he loves the idea of hunting more than the actual hunting. His sort of quarters, official palace or whatever it is, have got all these sort of, you know, animal heads all over them. But you never actually see him go out with a gun himself. He's more sending his people out to go and bring in these animals' carcasses. And the biggest prize is to have this tiger's head. So he sends out his men to try and get the tiger. And so that's part of the story. The other side is this. The hero of the film, a guy called Chun Man Duk, played by Choi Min Sik. I hope both those are okay. And he's basically the ultimate hunter. And he is, part of it, the story is his sort of personal drama. So him and his wife and his son, and how he doesn't really want to be hunting this tiger. And we find out why, and we see how it develops with his children, his child and his wife. Yeah, is that about right?
Well, yeah, there's a personal tragedy, and because of that, he decides to give up hunting, and instead becomes a, like, he gathers herbs, like medicinal herbs.
That's it.
From the mountain. He lives on the mountain, doesn't he?
He does.
And he gathers up herbs, and that's how he makes his living. And his son sort of works with him, and they go out looking for stuff and gathering it up, and then taking it into the local town to sell it.
Exactly.
But he used to be this big hunter, you know, and but he's given that up.
Yes, that's
for personal reasons.
For personal,
which we learn about through the course of the film.
Exactly. And so, yeah, he is the ultimate hunter who's given it up. And basically, this other team who've been employed by the governor to try and get the tiger want him to help them get him. And we find out what happens.
And this tiger, they call him the Lord of the Mountain, don't they?
Yeah.
Because he is, in fact, like very formidable, and he kind of owns the mountain, doesn't he? All the other animals are afraid of him. Everyone's afraid of him. He's a pretty nasty piece of work, isn't he?
He is extraordinary.
He's a very formidable, a killing machine, isn't he?
He is absolutely. When he, I mean, not giving too much away, I mean, he does kill people. But when he does it, there's no holds barred. There's just like loads of deaths, blood everywhere, and he's essentially pretty much invincible.
He is. And I think the idea, too, is that he's one of the last tigers.
They said in the part of the film.
Yeah.
He's the last tiger in Korea or in that mountain.
Yeah, because they've been going around hunting these animals for years, and he's basically, they've whittled them down to a very small group of them that are left. And then, again, because I think this happens quite early on in the film, so it's not much of a spoiler to say that this tiger's family gets killed by these hunters that are out looking for him.
It does, yeah.
And so he, in a very Ahab Moby Dick kind of way, this tiger is on a mission of vengeance against all these hunters that are on the mountain.
Exactly. He's basically saying, leave me alone. Get off my back. Get off my mountain.
Yeah.
And also, but he does also want to get revenge for, his cubs and mate being killed, I think.
And the film has a bit of a kind of a metaphysical aspect to it, doesn't it? Because there's, as through the film we learn that the relationship between this hunter and the tiger, there's history there, isn't there?
There is.
There's quite a complex and almost philosophical sort of link between these two characters.
At one stage I wrote down, they're frenemies.
They're frenemies, yes. Yes, yes. That's a good term for the hunter and the tiger, yes.
Yeah.
So there's a great well of history. There's a lot of baggage in the relationship with this animal and this hunter. And I guess a key part of the story is the fact that he is... this general, this Japanese encampment, this army general, and the people who kind of administer the area, and the group of hunters that they've hired to go out and catch this tiger.
Yeah.
They're trying to coax him because he's this renowned, highly respected hunter in the community who everyone knows. He's like the best there is. And they're trying to coax him to come and help to catch this tiger. And he's telling them, he's like going, ah, I ain't doing it. I'm done with that. I'm not having anything to do with it.
Yep.
But then, of course, circumstances, of course, as these stories tend to go, circumstances drag him into the story, don't they? Drag him into the events that are happening on the mountain.
They do. Basically, it's almost like fate has other plans.
Yes.
He's. I'm sure it's like a myth. He's one of these characters that doesn't want to be involved, but he's being dragged in, whatever he thinks.
Exactly.
I
mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, even though I think it's fair to say that all the tiger stuff is CGI, isn't it?
It is.
I don't think there's any actual real tiger footage in this film.
I don't.
And the majority of it, I mean, it's a fairly recent film, 2015.
Yeah.
I'm not necessarily a huge fan of sort of computer cartoons, computer generated sort of stuff. But most of, I would say the majority, maybe like sort of 80% of the tiger stuff in the film is very well done and very convincing.
Definitely. I guess
there may be a few scenes that are a bit more ropey than others, where it's definitely, he looks a bit more fake.
Yeah.
It's a bit more fake looking.
But that's the thing about both these films.
Yeah.
I guess for me, at least, one of the key things about sort of, you know, monster films, really, in the sense this is a subgenre of the monster film, is you don't really want to show that monster too much, or at least really be very sparing. But these ones, they do show, I mean, obviously the white dog, the dog's there all the time. But and then this one, you do see it quite a lot. And that's the nice thing about Jaws, is that Jaws is largely hidden.
Which was by accident, not design. It was more just circumstances meant that they didn't have as much shark footage in Jaws as they wanted to, because, or as they had originally planned, just because they couldn't get him to work and they had all kinds of technical problems. So that ended up being a happy kind of accident that worked in the film's favor to make the, you know, and it's the same with like Moby Dick. And, you know, I'm quite partial to John Huston's film of Moby Dick.
I think it's
the best one by a long shot.
Right.
And that, again, you don't actually see the big white whale very much at all in that film. Except towards the end, you know, but predominantly you don't see him that much. He's more just this thing, you know, and that builds up that tension and that suspense.
That's it.
So that when you do finally see it, it's like, whoa, man.
Yeah.
But you're right. These two films are much more, these animals are very much front and center. They're a pivotal sort of key element in the stories, and they are very prominent throughout the film.
First of all, I was thinking, it's sort of, you know, I thought, well, it's going to lose its sort of power, because the power of imagination is much more effective than CGI, basically. But once you sort of take it for what it is, it's a film where you're going to see this animal come out and sort of do its business, basically rip people apart. Well, you just have to say, okay, that's fine. And that's cool.
Well, the thing is, I mean, this sort of preoccupation that people have with sort of realism anyway, I think realism's a bit overrated, because I think you know, when you're going into a film, you know, if it's a fictional film and it's, you know, you know, you're not, what you're seeing isn't real.
Yeah.
And there should be a certain sort of latitude in your imagination that you leave to say, you know, yeah, it's not a real animal. Yeah, there are a few bits where maybe it looks a bit fake. But so what? You just suspend your disbelief You just go with it and you just enjoy it for what it is. And you don't like, because of course it's not a real tiger.
No.
But most of the stuff's quite effective, but there are a couple of scenes where he looks a bit more like sort of, mainly when he's doing these sort of feats of physical, you know, he's leaping and diving in things that are probably not particularly realistic.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look that realistic, but you just accept it because the idea of the story is that it's a more of a mythical story about this.
Exactly. It's more like a fable or a myth than a sort of, you know, strictly real. Exactly.
So you can accept that and just let yourself go with it.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah. Because there's enough that's enjoyable about the film that, that you don't have to quibble too much about that, I think.
I mean, I'm quite glad you picked this film because it was one I saw it when it came out. I don't think the film was particularly, you know, it wasn't a big huge hit or anything, and I don't think a lot of people saw it.
Yeah.
So I think it's good that we're bringing it back out and drawing attention to it because I think it is a kind of above average. It's quite a compelling story. It's very well done. All the performances are really good.
Yeah.
Some of the tiger scenes and the other animal scenes are some bits with some wolves, a pack of wolves and things as well. And there's quite a good lot of suspense and harrowing moments and things. And it's quite a really good story and a very entertaining one.
Yeah. Well, it's, as you said, it's like it's the mythic element, and I suppose the myth is really about main lessons is a sort of ecological myth, isn't it? Because they're hunting this animal to extinction, and essentially it is now extinct on the Korean Peninsula. Apparently, in preparation for the chat, I looked up. Siberian tigers, and they do still exist, but they're basically limited to part of Russia, sort of the far eastern Russia, in these woods where there's nobody lives, and there's some there, but there's a thing about the number of genes, because there's only a sort of few hundred really. You need more than a certain number in order to have a sort of healthy use of gene stock, and they're sort of don't quite have enough, I think. So they are very much endangered, and this is part of it due to the hunting, a lot of it, which is interesting. I was also thinking that the type, but it's all very well for us to say, they shouldn't hunt them, which is sort of, you know, undoubtedly true. We don't want animals to go extinct. But if you live in somewhere where there are tigers, you know, you're not thinking like that, basically, because you don't want to get eaten by a tiger. You don't want your animals to get eaten by tigers. And you'd rather sort of, you know, they were not doing that, not killing you and your livestock. And so probably hunting them is the sort of, well, that is what people did. And that's why there aren't so many around. And so, for instance, in India, they have the man-eating tigers occasionally. And I visited the country, and you occasionally hear of these parts of the country where tigers are still live. And, you know, the sort of farmers live in dread of these tigers sort of carrying off their sheep or whatever, and sort of maybe even them. And so then they have to get occasionally when there's, I think there's a theory, I don't know if it's true, but they sort of get a taste for human blood, and then they have to get in a hunter who's going to come and kill this sort of tiger that sort of actually has this taste. And it's that's really interesting that, yeah, you get where that leads to is where they just disappear altogether, basically, which isn't good.
But in this story, I mean, the idea is that they're not really hunting these animals out of necessity, are they? It's more...
Definitely not.
You know,
no.
And this mountain, let's face it, is quite...
remote.
Generally inhospitable for people.
Yeah.
So really, there's not really, they don't really have any real business to be hanging around there. They're just going up there to hunt these animals.
Yeah.
And they've kind of eventually wiped them up. And yes, there is the economic factor to say, well, they're doing it because they want to earn a living. And there is a key element in the story about the boy, isn't there?
Yeah.
That the fact that he wants to return. He wants to return to hunting because he's getting older and he wants to go and start his own family and have his own life separate from his father, his relationship with his father. So he wants to go back to hunting because he sees it as a way to earn a good living compared to, you know, gathering herbs and, you know, plants and things and taking them down to the town.
Yeah.
So there is that, but really the reality is they don't need to be hurting these animals. And then of course this animal sort of represents the sort of nature kind of, you know, fighting back.
I mean, the fact that they call him the Mountain Lord makes me think he's almost like a sort of spirit of the mountain or something like that. He has a sort of sacred quality to him, which was really nice, actually. It's a really enjoyable film, and the main character, the Chun Manduk is his name, and his character is really he's well, good. Perhaps I'll say that the actor Choi Min Suk is Choi Min Sik. He's really is got
terrific. Yeah, it's pretty across the board. It's got a great cast in it, and and there's some wonderful set pieces in it. As I said earlier, like there's some key bits, you know, when all the soldiers and the hunters go up and then the tiger has the big sort of showdowns with them and stuff. There's some quite effective and suspenseful scenes in it, and it's quite harrowing, the bit with the boy and the wolves, the pack of wolves. I won't go into detail. You don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen it, but there's some really good, I mean, it's a good cracking good adventure story, and I really enjoyed it, and I was glad to revisit, actually, because it was one of those things that, like I said, I saw it when it came out and then I'd kind of forgotten about it. So when you picked it, I went, oh yeah, actually that was a good film. I wouldn't mind seeing that again. And I really enjoyed revisiting it after, it's almost going on 10 years old now.
It's quite different from the previous film because it's not big budget, but it's sort of, you know, it's not a B movie in the same way that White Dog is, and it's but it does have certain. So I'm sure I heard a little bit of Jaws in the music again, and just that you know, the strings motif.
So was there anything else you wanted to say about the tiger?
Well, I would say, it had a different, it's different, it has similarities with White Dog as ever, but it also has differences. Yeah, it's much bigger budget film. And I guess it's sort of themes, it's sort of philosophical or sort of themes are sort of different, more about man and nature rather than sort of man and man, as it were. But one thing that they both shared is this sort of melodramatic quality, which is quite enjoyable, and sort of high emotion, which is, that's good. So
yeah, that's a good point to raise, is because both films are like Sam Fuller is used to making those kind of low budget sort of potboilers and sort of things, and everything's kept to a minimal and simple, straightforward. There's no ambiguities. There's no sort of arty sort of, pretense or anything like that. It's just sort of you know, boom, 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 great, you know, and that's one of the good qualities about his films.
Yeah.
But they do work as really great pieces of entertainment, but he always has a little bit more sociological or, you know, subtext to it, so, yeah, you know, that make them extra compelling and yeah, interesting to watch.
Yeah.
And I think The Tiger works on that level too, because it is at its heart, it's a, like you say, it's a monster movie. It's an, and it's a rip-roaring adventure sort of film, hunters out in the wilderness fighting yeah, against this giant beast, which is, seems unstoppable and everything. But it also has those extra layers yeah, that are quite beautiful and but simple, straightforward, not yeah, anything too complex like the films we talked about last time.
No.
You know, these are not you know, there's no rocket science going on here either, is there?
No. I mean, The Tiger's a sort of ecological fable, but it does have more bigger cast and also sort of subplots, whereas White Dog doesn't really, it just has the single plot, which is sort of like much more focused in on.
Yeah. And it's just kind of short and sweet and just, well, sweet, it's not the right word for sure. but it's, you know, it's short and to the point and just sort of, it tells a really straightforward story, plows ahead.
Yeah.
And gets there. Whereas The Tiger, I think, is a little bit more of sprawling, more epic in scale and scope.
That's it.
And it has, it like I say, it has that kind of, you know, like you say, that man against nature and that philosophical sort of edge to it,
which yeah,
makes it quite yeah, interesting as well.
Yeah. That's yeah, good. Should we say where we watch these things?
Yeah, actually, we didn't do it for White Dog either. So let's start with White Dog. If people wanted to go and search out White Dog.
I saw White Dog on Prime, which I hired it. I think it was about £3.50. And yes.
But yeah, I think I had a quick look. When I suggested it as my pick for the film, I then went frantically and went, oh, God, I hope it's actually available, because it's a relatively obscure film, I think. So
yeah,
I was a bit worried that you wouldn't be able to access it, but it is actually available. It's on Apple TV. It's on YouTube. It's on Prime, as you said, so people can find it quite easily if they want to stream it as a rental. It's out there, and I looked, this is still available, but there's also here, sorry, I gotta hold it so it doesn't go out of focus. I think it's out of focus, but there it is. It's the Masters of Cinema Blu-ray edition of White Dog. It's actually got a DVD. It's a Blu-ray and DVD dual format. This is still available. It's still in print. You can still get it on Amazon and wherever else you buy your stuff. So I would definitely recommend that. It's a good, not a lot of extra stuff, but it's got a really nice sort of booklet with interviews with Sam Fuller and, you know, Masters of Cinema, Eureka. They always do really good booklets with lots of great stuff. So that's worth picking up if you're really interested in watching it.
Yep.
And how about The Tiger? Where did you watch that one?
Also watched that on Prime, and that time I didn't even have to rent it. It's sort of part of your Prime package.
Oh, brilliant. So there you go. So if you've got Amazon Prime, you can watch it for no additional cost.
Exactly.
Brilliant. And I, again, sorry, it's out of focus, I think, on the camera, but this is from Eureka, same company that does the Masters of Cinema line. They have published a Blu-ray of The Tiger as well. It's a good film. It's worth checking out. But I would say for people who don't buy physical media, it's easily accessible on Amazon Prime at the minute. So go and watch it. It's a good evening's entertainment.
I'd say so, definitely.
Especially if you like little furry animals. Both of these films are wonderful.
Getting their own back.
Cute little animal videos. These will definitely be the ones for you.
Yeah.
So, On that note, anything else you wanted to say about either of the films, Jono?
No, but I feel like I have survived an animal attack this evening.
Why is that? Is it because your dog is gnawing on your ankle and below?
Exactly. Well, we can put a picture up of a photo of now.
Okay.
See, and see how unattack dog she is.
Oh, beautiful though. Look at that. Beautiful. Nice one. Okay. Well, I'm glad she. It's a she, isn't it?
It is a she. Yeah, she's a she.
Yeah, so I hopefully she didn't get too frightened by White Dog.
The funny thing was, watching that film, White Dog, there's lots of barking and howling, sort of dog sounds. She wasn't really bothered. Not bothered at all.
No. Which is, I think, because it's been recorded. It's not actual.
Yeah.
It's not actual animal sounds. They're kind of like, you know, they've been recorded and processed and stuff, so they maybe don't have the same.
Yeah.
Maybe they don't quite sound the same to them.
Yeah.
Sometimes, although I have seen sometimes, I've seen animals respond to animal noises on TV and on the radio and stuff.
Watching David Attenborough often, don't they?
Yeah.
What's that tiger doing? Or what's that lion doing there?
Yeah. Anyway. All right, folks. Well, thanks for joining us tonight, and we hope you'll go and check out these films, because they are both definitely worth a watch. Yes. If you're looking for a good critter film. And also, we want to hear from you if you want to recommend your favorite animal attack film, or you want to comment on any of the things that we talked about tonight, or about the films, or the performers, or anything like that. By all means, drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. Comment on the video, or send us a message on social media or whatever. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah.
And we're going to be back in a couple of weeks. So in the meantime, of course, go and check out our factoids, and go and watch these films, and take care of yourself wherever you are out there. Jonathan, always a pleasure having a chat.
Yep.
And folks, we'll see you soon.
Yes. Take care.
Oh, the things these nerdy middle-aged men get up to.